Thank you so much for inviting me to the lovely Beijing Foreign Studies University. It's been wonderful to be here already. And thank you so much for coming and sitting in the bitterness of late afternoon in the heat at 4:30 when you could all be off somewhere dancing. So I have been talking about conceptual integration, and some of you have not been in on these lectures. This morning I talked about frame blending, where we integrate two frames. So I'll just do a very quick recap with a different example, one involving language. Fillmore and Atkins have a classic analysis of the verb risk and the syntax of the verb risk and its meaning. Chuck Fillmore, as you know, is famous as the organizer of FrameNet and the famous linguist of frame semantics. And one of the things, and you can find everything I'm going to say here in Frame Blending, which is on the Cognitive Science Network. Thank you very much. Thank you. So you can find all of this by just go to my webpage, markturner.org, and you'll get the link for this. In any event, Fillmore and Atkins give an analysis of the frame for risk as essentially, they don't quite say this, but they might as well have, a blend of the frames of chance and harm. Now, I'd like to point out that these frames are separate. So if I say, well, there's a chance that it will be 30 degrees centigrade tomorrow and a chance that it will be 31 degrees centigrade, but we don't care which. That just means there's a possibility of one or the other, but there's no question of harm, right? Similarly, if there's harm coming and it's 100% guaranteed, then chance and possibility are not an issue. So harm and chance are quite independent as frames. But when you integrate them, you get one of the basic frames for risk, in particular, running a risk. And Fillmore and Atkins, in fact, use this diagram where a circle means chance. There's a chance of harm. There's also a chance of something else. And this is the structure of the basic frame of running a risk. But they point out that there is yet another blend of a frame into the frames of chance and harm, that is of choice, where you choose to put yourself into a position where there's a chance of harm. Now, this can be because you are betting on a horse or because, you know, you like the thrill of driving fast or something like that, right? So here we have the lexical meaning of risk as analyzed as a set of frame blends. You have to pull these things together. Now, this kind of blending is not cut and paste where you take everything from chance and everything from harm and everything from choice and put them all together. I'd point out, for example, that the harm frame automatically brings in an evaluator. If there's harm, there has to be harm to somebody who evaluates it that way. Think, for example, of a diamond and an owner. And if the owner wants it cut, then that's not harm. But if the owner did not want it cut, then that's harm. The harm is not to the diamond. The harm is to the owner. And then the interesting part of this analysis is Fillmore and Atkins talk about what they call derivative syntax, and I would call blended syntax. In other words, the syntax is following the blending of the conceptual frames. They say, for example, for a verb like smear, when you smear something on a surface that results in covering the surface, the verb smear acquires the syntax of cover, as in, I smeared the wall with mud, right? Now you can put smear in the spot where cover would go. And when loading hay onto the truck results in filling the truck, then load can take on the syntax of fill, as in, I loaded the truck with hay, right? You can say you filled the truck with hay, but when loading results in filling, you can now say, I loaded the truck with hay, right? So the point is that when you blend these frames, you get selective projection into the combination, into the blend, and you get projection of the linguistic elements that attach to those frames, and you get blended syntax for the blended frame. And I'll point this out in the case of risk. So, for instance, they point out that when risk means possibility, there is a slight risk, danger, possibility, then such and such, then risk can take on the syntax of possibility. It can acquire the syntax for expose, as in something like we'd have to reinforce the boat before risking it to the waves. That's because you can say exposing it to the waves, right? And it can acquire, through blending, the syntax for investing in something, as in Roosevelt risked more than $50,000 of his patrimony in ranch lands in Dakota Territory. That's because you can invest in something, right? So you get emergent syntax as part of emergent structure when you blend frames. This is what we do. Part of double scope blending is the blending of grammar associated with the frames being blended. Okay, so this is the kind of thing we've been discussing this morning and in other events. This morning I talk about the blending of frames, and I said this is going to be a day talking about the way in which blending, conceptual integration, interacts with some other very familiar conceptual phenomena like framing, where we frame something so we know how to act and we have an understanding. So this morning we were in a library and I pointed out that we have a frame for library. The library has books, there are librarians, we can check them out and so on. And these frames are frequently culturally inflected, sometimes entirely culturally built. So when we do frame semantics, frame analysis, and accordingly, syntax, we have to look at the cultural role and the historical role of building those frames. And I promised or threatened, whichever you prefer, that in the afternoon I would talk about the blending of stories, because story is another, probably the most basic mental operation for understanding, where we think of a small group of agents as interacting with each other in a very human scale scene. Sometimes we personify those agents, sometimes we don't. And when the rain rains on us and we get wet, that's a small spatial story. Bigger stories are things like legends about Dragon Boat Festival Day. Okay, so here we're going to talk about blended stories this afternoon as promised. And you've already seen one example of a blended story, so let me point out there's no point looking at the screen, it's French. Unless you read French, but if you listen to me, you'll follow. It goes like this. There was a stepmother, her name was Phaedra, and she had a stepson, Hippolytus. And Hippolytus is a beautiful man. And his father, Theseus, was gone. And she develops this passionate love for him, Phaedra for Hippolytus, and she is very restrained and tries to overcome it and so on. But finally she decides to avow her love to Hippolytus. And she starts off by recounting the story in which Theseus went to Crete and saved the people by delivering them from the Minotaur. There was a monster inside a labyrinth, a monster inside a maze. And her older sister, Ariadne, helped Theseus. Theseus the hero came down, went into the maze, conquered the monster, and managed to get out because there was a thread that Ariadne gave him to help him get out. And she says to him, he asks her, Hippolytus asks Phaedra, don't you miss your husband? And she says, sure I miss him. I love him, not the way he is now, unfaithful, running around the world, but the way he was when I met him. And she describes him in wonderful terms and says that he was the way we paint our gods. So that's already a blend. that is, of Theseus and the representation of gods. And then she says, or the way you look. Now, this is an analogy. It's not hard to imagine because, of course, this is the adult son of Theseus. So, of course, Hippolytus looks something like Theseus and, of course, looks something like Theseus did when he was young. And Phaedra is much, much younger than Theseus and not all that far away from Hippolytus' age, right? Or the way you look to me. You have his carriage, his bearing, his language and things like that. And then she says, why couldn't you have come down to Crete? Now, of course, that was impossible, but she's imagining a story. And in this story, Hippolytus is now blended with his father Theseus. That is, Hippolytus here in this scene in front of Phaedra is now combined with Theseus, who went down and defeated the monster, defeated the Minotaur. Now she's imagining that Hippolytus did it. She said, you could have been the one to deliver us from the monster. You could have done it. You could have been the one to whom my sister gave the thread. Right? We're doing okay so far. It's a blended story. Now she makes another step. She says, oh no, I would have gone with you. I would have helped you out. I would have given you the thread. And she says, but that would not have been enough for your lover. I would have gone into the maze with you and succeeded or died in the maze with you. My love would have... And Hippolytus is kind of surprised at this because one inference that you can get in the blend is that in the blend, she's the lover of her stepson, Hippolytus. But of course, it's just an imaginary blend. And so he says, madam, have you forgotten that Theseus is my father? She says, what makes you think I've forgotten? You know, this is just an analogy, not a blend. She does. And he says, oh, I see, I'm sorry. And she says, oh, cruel one, you have understood me all too well. Well, you've seen this before. This is an example of a blending of stories in which you have two quite distinctive stories with different characters. Hippolytus is, of course, not even in the story of the Minotaur. And Phaedra certainly did not go into the maze with Theseus, right? And you have selective projection to the blend. That is, only some things from the stories are put together in the blend. And you also have emergent structure. Now in the emergent structure, Phaedra and Hippolytus are lovers. And notice they are not lovers in these two stories, right? But now in the blend, they are lovers. And of course, that's exactly what Phaedra wants to communicate to him. And he understands that this can have significance for the scene that they're in. And I would put it to you that throughout human discourse, there are often many things people cannot say directly to each other or they don't want to. So they hint. And one of the ways they do that is by constructing a blend that has the inferences they want in the blend so that they can say it without its being claimed that they have in fact said this. And this is all over the place in movies. So for instance, there's an actor and an actress in high school or something, and the boy has managed to get himself into the role of Romeo and she's Juliet. And then he gets to say, you know, it is the East, and Juliet is the Sun, you know. He gets to profess with his body and his words this undying love, right? And there's a pretext. It's just acting, right? This is not a blend. This is just acting, right? People do this all the time. Watch how they start dating. Oh, I once had a friend who... Right. Okay. The blended story of Phaedra connects elements of the two stories, vital relations, our old friend, identity, analogy, cause-effect, part whole, time, space, all of these sorts of connections that we have seen many, many times. There's selective projection to the blend. Only some things from each story come into the blend. There is emergent structure. It's Hippolytus who conquers the Minotaur. Hippolytus and Phaedra are now lovers. And as we've mentioned many times, there is now language that can apply to the blend. that is not appropriate to the two stories. So she can say, your lover, votre amante, of herself in the blend, because that applies in the blend, even though it doesn't apply in the two input spaces. So now I'm going to introduce a new example. Okay? I'm going to see some blended stories. This is a poem by William Butler Yeats. And it is a lyric poem in the voice of a man who's about 60 and is visiting a school. He's a public official, and he's coming to visit the school and say nice things to the children. Yesterday was, what, International Children's Day or something? It's like that. He comes, and there's a play and that kind of thing. Now, that's one story. There's the 60-year-old public official visiting the school. And in another story, of course, there's the woman that he loved madly when he was young. Okay? These are two very different things, two very different stories. And he begins talking from the voice of the man who's in the school. I walk through the long schoolroom questioning a kind old nun. The nuns, this is Ireland, and the nuns are often the teachers. A kind old nun in a white hood replies, the children learn to cipher, that's right, of course, and do arithmetic, and to sing, to study reading books and history, to cut and sew, be neat in everything, in the best modern way. The children's eyes in momentary wonder stare upon a 60-year-old smiling public man. So he's the 60-year-old smiling public man, and the children look at him, right? He's visiting a school. Now the next one is thinking of a quite different story. And that's the woman he was in love with. I dream of a Lydian body. It's Leda and the Swan, the beautiful female. Zeus visited Leda in the form of a swan because she was so attractive and mated with her. Bent above a sinking fire, a tale that she told of a harsh reproof or trivial event that changed some childish day to tragedy. So he's remembering the woman he was in love with. And that's one story. Over here there's this other story of the 60-year-old man in the school. And she's remembering a story from her childhood of when there was some sort of, she was punished or criticized or something harsh was said to her. So we've got three stories going on now, right? That changed some childish day to tragedy, told, and it seemed that our two natures blent into a sphere from youthful sympathy, or else to alter Plato's parable into the oak and white of the one shell. That's quite complicated. You don't need to follow that. But here comes the big blend. So he's still in the school, right? And thinking of that fit of grief or rage, so he's remembering the woman, so man in school, much younger, remembering the woman. The woman is telling the story of when she was a child. So we've got three stories running, right? And in the story she's telling, she's a child. And over here, he's 60 years old, and he's visiting the school children. There are children in these two stories. But in one of the stories, she's a grown woman, and they are very passionately in love, okay? So there's an identity from her as a young girl to her as the adult woman, his lover. And there's an analogy from the school child that she was to the school children that he's in front of now. Well, these all get compressed. I look upon one child or t'other there. So he's looking at the children who are right in front of them and wonder if she stood so at that age. We're still having analogy. You know, could she have stood like that? He didn't know her when she was a child. For even daughters of the swan can share something of every paddler's heritage. That means, you know, even really exceptional women can be like normal girls, right, when they were young, and had that color upon her hair. So the analogy is starting to get kind of tighter between his lover when she was a child and the schoolgirls that he's looking at. And thereupon, my heart is driven wild. She stands before me as a living child. He sees her. Right? In the blend, there she is. Now, he's not deluded. Right? But suddenly, this great range of meaning that's very hard for humans to hold on to is compressed down into a blend where it's right in front of him. And here's the point. Notice the emergent structure. Nobody that I've ever talked to interprets this as he wants to have sex with a little girl. Right? See, notice everybody laughs. That's good. But why not? That didn't get projected down. It's in the story with, and he is driven wild. The next thing to notice is you can now use words like she. Who's this she? The she applies to the lover up in this space or to the child that she was, or both of them. It doesn't apply to this girl over here, but now it does in the blend. You can use she of this girl who is not that girl, and it's not ungrammatical. Words are prompts to construct meaning. And she stands. Notice it's present tense. What's strange about that? Please answer. What's strange about using the present tense for his lover? I'm not talking till you tell me. Present tense. Is she here? No. She's only in the past. Okay? But he can now use the present tense, that's grammar, of her, because it applies to the blend. Also, as a living child. Now, isn't that a little weird? He's in front of a bunch of children. They're all alive, of course. They're school children. Right? Suppose I said, I am so happy to see you living students. Yes, that's no good. I would look like somebody who doesn't speak English, right? But here it's fine. And the reason it's fine is that up in these input spaces, she's not living anymore. Those are past, right? But here she is living, so it's okay. And notice none of you had any problems with she stands before me as a living child. That's because the grammar is legitimated by the blend. The grammar picks out things that are in the blend. And you know how to map the blend back to all of these stories and hold on to it, right? So even in a spectacular pyrotechnic case like this, a 60-year-old man remembering, you know, the daughter of Zeus, Apollo and Leda, and all like that. Even this 60-year-old man in a schoolroom being blended, blending a child with his former lover, and a memory he has of what she told. Very, very pyrotechnic. But you don't notice the real blending, which is all of this grammar that becomes available and would be ungrammatical to you. Notice how I could make you laugh by calling you living students, right? But it seems perfectly fine to you because in the backstage of your cognition, you've already done all of this work. So here we have, notice, I said in Racine, she can refer to herself as your lover, votre amant, in the blend. This morning I talked about how Catullus could refer to mute ashes. That's language that's not grammatical for ashes, but it's fine for the blend. Nobody has any trouble. Same thing. She stands before me as a living child. Okay? Now, I want to now step back a minute to something very basic, and that's about other minds. I'm going to talk about stories again in a second, but to get there, I have to talk about the way you look at other people and at animals. So suppose you look at a seal. There's a seal, you know, in the water. It's a water animal. Fine. No problem. The seal is analogously just like you. It has eyes, and the eyes are open, and they have a direction, right? And they're active. Okay. Now, you cannot see that the seal has a mind. You can't see that. You can't feel that. But you know you have one. And when you look at something with your eyes, you notice, you know that you're seeing something. And you're paying attention to it. Right? So you can make a blend, without ever thinking that you're doing anything at all, of you and the seal. And now the seal has a mind. So its eyes are not just open and round and active. They are they are inspecting and attentive. They have intention. They have perspective. Notice you can't see these things. You can't see that the seal is perceiving. You cannot see that the seal has goals. But in the blend, there's a seal with a mind. Now, what do I mean? Well, what I mean up here is you see the seal, and the seal has analogies to you. And down comes the seal, but you know about having a mind and having perceptions and so on, and it's the easiest, it's absolutely inevitable, you can hardly resist it. Even when I say to you that this is a blend, it's hard to see. Well, of course a seal has a mind. Don't you think a seal has a mind? Of course I do. I don't think the blend is false. It's not quite like mine, but I do think the blend has, the seal has a mind. This scientific hypothesis is a blend, like almost all scientific hypotheses, like almost all the things that we think are in fact true. And the seal can perceive in the blend. Okay? Now that's great. In fact, this is exactly what we do with each other. The seal has a perspective, for example. I think you have a perspective, right? I can't see from your perspective, but I can imagine it. I can see from my perspective. So, for example, I want you all right now to imagine that you're me. And I want you to see yourselves. Go ahead. You can do it, right? You can, you get the meaning. You can take on my perspective in imagination. If you couldn't do that, we would be very bad at social cognition and we wouldn't be able to run language the way we do, because language very much depends upon being able to assign perspectives, often ones that are not our own. This is well known in linguistics. Okay? This is what we do with each other. This is what we do with the seal. Okay, now I want to give you a slightly different blend. There's a seal, there's a human being, and we have selective projection to the blend. And in the blend, we have not a seal with a mind, but a selkie. Now, I did not know what a selkie was until I was in my 30s, maybe 40s. A selkie is a legendary being from the Orkney Islands in the United Kingdom. Selkies are shapeshifters. There's a great category of shapeshifters in mythology and legend. A selkie is like a seal, looks like a seal, but it can take off its coat. And when it takes off its coat, wow, does it look great. That's at least how the legend usually goes. And so the story is that the Selkies dance with each other on the level shore in the moonlight, and the really attractive, really attractive Selkie, male Selkies, take off their coats and slip into the villages and mate with the human females, who are really, really, really happy about it. And so in these legends, you know, in the Orkney Islands, there are stories about if you have a child whose toes look a little, webbed, and you know, human beings sometimes do have webbed toes, well, then we know how that child got there, right? Right? Okay, well, the Selkies dance on the level shore, and one way to... I'll get to that. Okay, so now we have these Selkies who can put on and take off their coat. Selkies have inspection, attention, intention, perspective, just the way we saw with the seal, only much richer human stuff. But they've got some of what the seal got. has. They've got some of what the seal has. The seal understands the sea and the elements and knows the weather, right? So these are special kinds of human beings. This falls into the category of talking animals, right? Talking animals may seem strange, but in fact, talking animals are the mainstay of the nursery. This is just what we do all the time. It's just what children do all the time. And we're very familiar with this from cartoons like Goofy and Pluto and Scooby-Doo. And these are three different blends of human being and dog. And the dogs talk and behave in different ways. So Goofy talks in a very goofy kind of way. Pluto doesn't talk at all. Scooby-Doo talks in a kind of human voice with doggish overtones. Donald Duck, of course, is the standard one. Now, no duck talks like that, although a human being can and did, you know, imitate Donald Duck, you know. Right? Just very, very normal for us to do. This Selkie has a removable coat, which is something like the clothes that human beings have. It's a coat that you put it on and you're a seal, but when you take it off, you're a human. Not exactly, because of course human beings can't put on a coat and turn into a seal, and not exactly a seal because seals can't take off their coats and turn into human beings. And they're vulnerable when they take off their coats because they're stranded on land. Right? They're vulnerable. Something the way a human being is when they're naked. So here comes the myth. The myth is that Scottish Orkney Island human males would like to capture the coat of a Selkie female so that she would marry him because she couldn't go anywhere, you know, and he'd have her coat. It's very manipulative, very manipulative. And so there are these stories about the man who falls in love with the Selkie and tries to get her coat and promises, you know, if you have children with me and stay with me, because Selkies live a long time, she'll give him back the coat. Okay. Now, in this Selkie blend of Selkie worlds where there are Selkies, notice we're blending stories here. And we're getting lots of emergent structure. Now, you have to explain where Selkies came from. Now, notice, by the way, that what happens in the case of the seal, the way we explain how the seal gets a mind is by assuming that it's in the input. We say, what do you mean? How do I think that a seal has a mind in the blend? Why is there a mind in the blend? It's because seals have minds, as if we just assume that it's up there in the input. And that's what we would do with each other. Why do I think you have a mind? Because you do, right? And that's true. I do think you have minds. And I think it's scientifically right that you have minds. And I have a lot of scientific reason for thinking that. But, of course, the way I can do it is by blending, right? Blending is a road to mathematical insight and scientific discovery, indeed just understanding. But if you don't just say, now in the case of Selkies, you can't say, why can a Selkie take off its coat? Why are there Selkies? Why do they have this ability? You can't just say, oh, Selkies can take off their coats and become human beings because seals can. Right? You don't just stick it back up there in the input as if that part comes down from the input. You're not content with that explanation. And you can say, oh, I don't need an explanation at all, it's just fantasy. Or you can come up with some others. So, for example, one of the things that you can do is say, well, there's a reason for it. And this is common for us. Spider-Man, how did Spider-Man become Spider-Man? He got bit by a radioactive spider. There's a dog named Martha Blah Blah who can talk. The reason she can talk is she eats alphabet soup and the letters go not to her stomach but to her brain, so now she can talk. These stories are often full of little explanations, in jest explanations, for how these kinds of animals come about. Well, in the case of Selkies, there are three explanations. One, if a human being dies by drowning, it becomes a Selkie. Two, it's cosmic justice. That says justice. It should say justice. It's cosmic justice. If you do something wrong, you're condemned to being a Selkie. Another one is that these are fallen angels. When the angels were ejected from heaven, they fell. And those that landed on earth became fairies, and those that landed on sea became Selkies. So you can go on like this. You can develop all kinds of emergent structure in the blend of these stories. Well, now I want to tell you about a big story. This is a story for children called Aunt Charlotte and the NGA Portraits. And in this story, there's a woman named Olga Weathers. And when you're about halfway through the story, this is a story that's on the Outer Bank Islands of North Carolina. It's called Ocracoke. It's quite a remote place with sand dunes and the sea and waving wind. About halfway through, you figure out that Olga Weathers is a Selkie. It takes that long. Now, the word Selkie is never used in the story, and when I read this story, I'd never heard of the legend of Selkies, so I thought this was invented by the author. You don't need to know anything about Selkies to follow the story. And it so happens that a bad man stole Olga's coat, but she wouldn't marry him because she knew she would never get it back. And this man, knowing that Olga was very capable, had to hide it from her. So he hid it. He hid it in a picture. Now, what I mean is that he hid it in a picture is the following. So we have one world, which is Selkie world. You blend the seals with the human beings, you blend those stories, you get Selkies, you get an emergent world. Now we're going to talk about pictures. It's very common for us to blend a represented element with its representation. We saw this in Harold and the Purple Crayon, where the real moon that gives light is blended with the drawing of the moon. In Harold's world, when he draws the moon gives light. So now there's a unique element that compresses the moon and the drawing of the moon, right? When Harold draws something, it's real. It's a popular book for three-year-olds. And so this is what we do. We fuse it into a unique element in the blend. This is, in fact, entirely standard. If I show you a flat 2-inch by 2-inch thing that doesn't move, and I say, this is my son. Right? No problem. Now, you're not deluded. You're not deluded. You know that this is a blend, and it's a compression of a representation link and an analogy link, because the picture of his face looks something like his face or has some of the topological features. And also notice, I don't have to say, this is a picture of the head of my son. I can say, this is my son, right? Because in the blend, that refers to the blended element. No problem, okay? And you may think that you are impervious to the feelings that come up here, but that's not true. I have a friend who had a picture of his son on the desk, and it was the face of the child in kindergarten, and the picture fell over it just fell over like this because it was bumped, and he immediately snatched it up to see if the glass had been broken, right? Now, they had many copies of this picture. Big deal, right? It's just a nothing, right? But in the blend, the glass smashing, you know, just think about pictures that you have, how you feel when you look at the picture. People talk to pictures and so on. You're not crazy. Look at icons. Look at all sorts of things. We commonly use these blends to bring things to human scale. We're not deluded, but this is very, very useful to managing. Okay. So you have a representation and an analogy link. Well, the story here is that in Olga's world, there are paintings. And they are paintings, in fact, they're the paintings that are in our world, because it is our world. And in fact, these paintings have names. The difference is, in Olga's world, you can blend the painting with the reality. And the painting becomes a world. It's not the world, but it's picture world. And if you look at it very closely, and you're a very intelligent kind of person, sensitive to emotion, you can start to see the people in the picture moving. You can see the wind blow in the trees. You can see the waves move. And, you know, look out that window, just very quickly. It's a framed glimpse, right? One of the things that we incorporate into this picture world is our knowledge of a framed glimpse. Or here's a portal. You look out the door, and you see something through the door, right? One of the things you know about that is what you see is just part of the world. It goes on, right? So there's a building, but there's more building I can't see because it's framed. And people can walk past, and when they disappear, they don't disappear. They're in the rest of the world. And moreover, I could go through the window. So if you blend, or through the door, or through the portal, if you now blend that into picture world, where there are things in the picture and they're moving, you can also enter it. You can go through the frame. This gets used all the time in TV and films. Things come out of the TV into your living room. You chase them back into the TV. This is just extremely common. Okay? Now, notice that when I show you a picture and there's somebody standing on a bridge and you don't see the rest of the bridge, you assume that there's more bridge. You just don't see it. And there's bridge behind the person. In fact, the person has a back, right? Even though you don't see it. So you already complete very much a world for the representation you see. And this is true even for a painting that you know is completely fictional. Somebody paints something in Mars, right? Somebody standing on a bridge. You know none of this exists. It's a green monster or something like that. But you complete, you know, I can say, what do you think is standing behind this green monster? And that question is intelligible, okay? Well, now in Olga's world, you can actually take the Selkie coat and hide it in a painting. And this is what the bad man did. He hid it in a famous painting by Canaletto in Venice. And Olga Weathers did an awful lot of work to find it. The man, in the meantime, hunted narwhals and got a wound that turned septic and died. Now, why can't Olga just go in and get the coat? Well, Olga's the different kind of Selkie than the ones in the Met. When she takes off her coat and ages, she's not young and lithe, she's now sort of ample. And the frame of the picture is, she's stout. But the frame is something she can't get through. But even worse, this picture has the Grand Canal of Venice across the bottom. So if she did go through the picture, she'd fall into the water, and a Selkie without its coat will drown. Now think of it, that's really very inventive to manipulate the Selkie with fear of drowning, because that's the thing that they do best when they have their coat on, right? Okay. So what is she going to do? There are many, many, many other things that are silently going into this this picture world. Well, what she needs to do is, so we have a blend of Selkie world, which is one kind of story, with a blend of picture world, and now we get Selkie world that is also picture world. It's got picture world in it. Well, there's a young girl named Marguerite, and Marguerite is in Ocracoke, and she's never had any friends, and she's lonely, and her parents love her, but they ignore her because they're busy. And she doesn't have any friends, and back in, she lives in Washington, D.C., or Virginia. And back in Virginia, well, you know, she has to go to stupid tea parties with her mother, and she doesn't, you know, she loves her parents and so on, but it's not really working out. Well, Olga finds Charlotte and discovers that Charlotte's a very inventive, creative child who's very good at figuring out jigsaw puzzles and so on. They become very good friends, and Olga wants to protect Charlotte. But finally, when Charlotte can see the pictures moving, because Charlotte has learned from Olga, and the picture is in Olga's house in North Carolina, in Ocracoke, next to the sea, finally, Olga allows Charlotte to go into the painting to try to get the coat back. And she does. She puts her foot up on the frame, which feels solid as a rock banister, and the reason it's solid as a rock banister is it is a rock banister in the blend. Throws herself in, lands in the Grand Canal, swims over to the side. Trouble, how can she get up? Well, now, there are interesting things in this world. One thing you find, for example, is although it's got all the physics of the world, The people in the picture can't see her. She's not there. Why? Because she's not the picture. But somebody helps her up. How can somebody help her up if nobody can see her? Well, the answer is that there are analogies across different pictures, all the different paintings, and they form a kind of picture world in which characters from one painting can move into other paintings, right? And so Olga has gotten a bunch of children whose names are Celeste, Antonio, Carolyn, and Ranuccio to come from other Renaissance paintings into this painting by Canaletto in order to help Charlotte. So they pull her up. And she finally figures out that they're from these other paintings, right? And there's a lot of discussion about what picture world is like. So for instance, if you eat a chicken and you go back, the chicken is still there. And if you penetrate into the buildings too far, it just turns into a gray mist because, as Ranuccio says, it's just a picture, right? It's not a full world, right? So they go looking for the coat, and they find a door with a doorbell, and it's got a number like 5637B. And Charlotte, who's a great puzzle master, understands this is not in the picture. This is not part of Canaletto's Venice. So she goes and starts to go in, and the other children cannot go in with her because they say it's not the picture, and they can't go out of picture world. She goes in and enters the door. This is not the painting, say the kids. She goes in, enters the door, and of course, there's the room that has all these hunted animals that are like trophies. And there's Olga's coat. And as she takes it and is about to leave, this harlequin wakes up and says, "What would you want with that old thing?" Now, this is an amazing blend because it's sort of somebody from the Venetian Mardi Gras blended with something that can read her mind, or is it a projection of her own mind? And he says, listen, you don't want to go back home. Back home you have no friends. You have to go to boring tea parties. And you know that woman Olga, she doesn't really love you. She's just using you. Why don't you just stay here? You could have friends. And then he makes a big mistake though. He says, you could live forever. And suddenly, Charlotte realizes that she doesn't want to live forever. She wants to grow up and go to college. Now, this is amazing because the story of Charlotte as a child is like 70 years ago, right? It's that long ago, right? And so out she goes. She takes the coat to Olga. Olga turns back into a Selkie and goes into the sea. Now, what's the point of all this? Well, some of it is fantasy, but there are other sorts of things. This story is being told by Charlotte when she's somebody's great aunt. The story is called Aunt Charlotte and the NGA Portraits. And it's being told to a young girl who's named Marguerite, who's just about the age that Charlotte was. That Charlotte was when she went through the picture. And Marguerite is, you know, not really getting along with her parents. She's kind of lonely. She doesn't have friends. She comes up and visits her Aunt Charlotte, who seems kind of remote, but they're taking a taxi cab down to the National Gallery of Art, the one on the Mall in Washington, D.C. NGA, that's what that NGA stands for, it's the National Gallery of Art. And this story is being told by old Charlotte, the great aunt, to Marguerite. And when they get to the art gallery, of course, by now we know that Charlotte is quite wealthy. She married a man who did very, very well, and he loved her. And he bought these paintings for the National Gallery of Art. And in fact, most of them are in the National Gallery of Art. You can go look at Celeste and Antonio and Ranuccio in the National Gallery of Art, right? But there's another big blend that's going on here. One, of course, is from Marguerite as a child to Charlotte as a child, because Marguerite is trying to say, listen, you can have a life, you can grow up, you can imagine, right? But the real blend, the real big blend is, of course, with the reader of the book. This is a children's book, right? So there the child is, age 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, in a situation trying to imagine what it means to have a life, and what you get in the story is this fabulous blend of Selkie world, picture world, into Selkie picture world with Charlotte in it, Charlotte blended with Marguerite, and the whole thing blended in the mind of the reader. Now, what I want to point out is this is just what we say in the United States is duck soup. I don't know if that has the same meaning here. I just had duck soup for lunch. It was wonderful, really wonderful. But duck soup means something completely easy. You don't even have to notice. These are the kinds of things people read for fun, right? It seems like no work at all. And it's blend upon blend upon blend upon blend, selective projection, emergent structure, language that only makes sense because it refers to the blend, blends that are prompted by certain kinds of linguistic constructions. Now, tomorrow, when we're going to be talking about technical aspects of language, it's going to seem for a minute as if we're in a different world. But the point is, this kind of mental operation is something that human beings do all the time. It's our main method of creativity. It's why we can have cultural invention. It's why we're able to have language in the sense that without it, we wouldn't be able to have language. It's why we have art, music, mathematical insight, scientific discovery, fashions of dress, advanced social cognition, and these kinds of things. I'm putting up this because it's very pyrotechnic. It does. Notice, however, we started off with the risk frame, harm, chance, choice. And there you were seeing things that just looked, I mean, you use the verb risk all the time without ever thinking about why can I say risk in or risk to or risk on, right? Way below anything you would notice. This is the same operation, only now it's been put on stage by an artist who is showing you. It's very, very hard to show human beings, to get them to notice that they're doing this, because it's just automatic. Mostly you can't call these operations into consciousness any more than you can call vision into consciousness, right? Vision's very, very complicated. But you still might be prompted to think, well, it's a kid's story. Kids are, very imaginative, okay? And it's just a kid's story. I would say, well, I don't really understand that, because if children can do this so well, they can do it, with the runaway bunny at age 2, with Harold and the purple crayon when they're 3, and also, by the way, they can learn how to use the verb risk at an early age, right? That should really tell us something about human operation. But just to make certain we're all on the same page, let's look at something from the high canon of literature. This is from King Henry VI, Part 1, Shakespeare. Lord Talbot is in France fighting against the French. He's English. His son John has come over against the wishes of his father. They've been separated for 7 years. They're in a very, very bad fight. The French are dominating the field. The father, Lord Talbot, tries to get his son John to flee. John will not. He fights against the French. He is wounded and dies. He dies in the arms of his father, of his aged father, after they have been separated for 7 years. Okay? And Lord Talbot speaks to death, right before the death. Triumphant death, smeared with captivity, young Talbot's valor makes me smile at thee. So he tells the story of the battle and the fighting and the sea of blood, calls him his Icarus. I won't even begin to go through the linguistic and conceptual blends in considering this child. But here's the one that I want us to look at. He says, thou antic death which laughest us here to scorn. In other words, he's personifying death, and death is laughing at them, right? Anon, which means soon, from thy insulting tyranny, so death is like a tyrant, has the power, but is a jerk, right? Coupled in bonds of perpetuity, two Talbots winged through the lither sky, in thy despite shall scape mortality. What that means is, despite you, we're going to go to heaven, right? And thou, now he's speaking to his son, his dying son, John, and thou, whose wounds become hard-favored death, speak to thy father ere thou yield thy breath. In other words, before you die, speak to me. Brave death by speaking. whether he will or no. Imagine him a Frenchman and thy foe. Poor boy, he smiles, methinks, as who should say, had death been French, then death had died today. Okay, what this means is, death is their common enemy personified. And in this situation, loyalty to the father, support for the English, and courage all unite in the same direction, which is to speak. That's why he says, brave death by speaking. You know, just resist it, right? Poor boy, he smiles as one who, where the smile, I'm reading the smile as meaning, if death had been French, I'd have killed him. You know, the only reason I couldn't kill him is because he's deaf, not French. Okay, so let's start to look at these blends. Well, down here we have death, the French warrior foe, who gets slain in this imaginary scene. That is a blend of John Talbot the warrior and a French warrior. But over here, we have John Talbot the warrior who is slain by death the warrior foe, the personified death, who's, you know, in the field. Now, death, this great power, is a warrior and kills John Talbot. But down here in the blend, death becomes French. And so death dies. Notice the emergent structure, right? Above this blend, John Talbot dies. But now in this counterfactual, imaginary, blended story, it's death who dies. John defeats him. But wait a minute. There's death the warrior foe. How do you get death the warrior foe? Well, it's not so hard in the sense that you do it all the time. We say things like, if John were David, he'd be married by now. Now notice, that doesn't mean that John or David have to be married. Because, you know, maybe David's rich and John's not, and David doesn't want to get married, but John does. And if John were rich, he could get married. So if John were David, he'd be married by now, or he'd be rich by now, or he'd be a stockbroker, or he'd use his mobile phone. If John were French, he would have attended the École des Études en Sciences Sociales. He would prefer to lecture in English, or he would live in the Lyonnais. We do this all the time. We make blended scenes of different people in order to tell us something about the inputs. Okay, if death were French, had death been French, then death had died today. This looks spectacular, but it's just something we do all the time, prompted by these kinds of linguistic constructions. All right? So let's skip over that and over that. And now, remember I said, we have to account for death the warrior foe. Remember, up here we had death the warrior foe who triumphs, and now down here death gets slain. Now we have to account for death the warrior foe, triumphant death. Well, that is a blend. And here he kills John Talbot in this one. Well, that's a blend of John Talbot the warrior and French warrior foes, and the warrior in triumphant death is a warrior foe, and so he kills John Talbot. But where do we get triumphant death the warrior foe? Well, we have to account for that one. That is a blend of there's a warrior who slays and a warrior who is slain. That's one story. And over here is another story. The person resists but dies because there's a personified death. Now he's not a warrior, right? But personified death who acts to cause the event of dying. This can be the Grim Reaper. This can be just personified death. Blended with a warrior now becomes death, the warrior foe. But where do we get personified death? Well, that's a blend. A person dies is a story, and another person is the causal agent of causing that dying, of that event of dying. But over here, a person dies, and death in general, now this is not a person, death in general, the cause is the cause of dying. And by death in general, I mean what we mean when we say death catches up with everybody, or death comes to everyone, or no one can escape death. And I don't mean that there's a personified death. I mean death happens. Now, that may sound strange. Well, of course that happens. But there are lots of different kinds of death. People die of old age, they die of disease, they die of accidents, they die of murder, they die of war, they die of all kinds of things. But above all this, we think there's death. And everyone is subject to death. Death, the general cause. As I said the other day, this is part of a uniform causal tautology we have. What causes death? Death. What causes lust? Lust. Right? An individual act of lust is caused by lust. What causes hunger? Hunger. Hunger made me do it, right? Right? There's this generalized cause that we think of as sort of in the world. And this goes on. You know, sloth causes slothfulness. Watch out for sloth, we say. Well, where does that come from? Well, that's the causal tautology. That is, you have a person and a specific event of dying and a manner. This is what happens all the time. And over here, you have elements of a class of events and causes and an empty cause, and we create, this is a very, very common blend to put together. In this one, death in general causes the event of dying by specific means. Okay, so now let's look at this. This is what you need in order to understand, poor boy, he smiles, methinks, as one would say, had death been French, then death had died today. To get John Talbot slaying the death warrior, you have to blend John Talbot dominates the French warrior with triumphant death, the warrior slays John Talbot. To have triumphant death, the warrior slays John Talbot, you have to have triumphant death, the warrior slays a human being blended with John Talbot slain by the French warriors. To get triumphant death, a warrior who slays a human being, you have to blend warriors in combat with personified death acting to cause the event of dying. To get personified death, you have to be able to blend death in general with an intentional causal agent who performs actions that cause events. And to get death in general, you have to blend human death, all those different human deaths, with the causal tautology. Now, this man is driven to try to get his son to speak to him, and this is the defining moment of his role in the play. And what he does is turn to the blending of stories to give human meaning and to persuade people. I don't have time to do it today, but I would like to refer you to lots of other work on things like blended stories in Paradise Lost, where you have Satan, sin, and death. Satan, in the allegory, is attracted to sin, and so sin, a beautiful young woman, is born from his brow, the way Athena is born from the brow of Zeus, and she's attractive. I mean, he thinks of sin, and that's like conceiving a child. So in the blend, when he thinks of sin, there's a child. And sin is attractive, so she's attractive. And he, of course, is Satan. By the way, just having Satan already is a blend. And we're not talking here about belief. We're talking about conception. The question is not whether you believe this or that or the other. The question is how you conceive of things, right? So he mates with her. They have an affair, an incestuous affair, of course. He's Satan, after all. And she gives birth to a child, and the child is death. And you think in the allegory, Satan and sin, if you're attracted to sin and you give in to sin, then the consequence is death, and you thought it was going to be wonderful, but in fact it's horrible. Now death is going to come kill you. Death is a terrible monster. She's terribly deformed by this birth in the way that sin that seems attractive ends up being ugly, made ugly by the consequences of sin. Goes on forever. There's a nice analysis of this. The Dream of the Rood is an example. A pyrotechnic blend upon blend upon blend. We have a standard frame of punishment. Somebody sins, or somebody commits a crime, and then we do something bad to them. But this isn't they did a bad thing, we do a bad thing. On the contrary, they get these two things, the crime and the punishment, get compressed into a balanced unit. And the action we perform on them is not changed, but now it counts as punishment instead of doing a bad thing because it's unified in the blend. Okay. Well, we can also have the concept of an unpunished crime or an unpunished sin. That's where you have the sin or the crime, but no punishment. Okay? And people can be quite distressed about the fact that somebody committed a crime but did not get punished for it. Well, then there's this guy named Jesus who was unsinning. And you take all the unpunished sins of all of humanity and you compress them down with Jesus. Jesus takes the sins upon himself. He is punished, and that clears, that balances out. And there are a lot of other blends that come in this. The Lamb, the Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccati mundi. Okay, so that's just background. Now in the Dream of the Rood, Rood means cross. There's a guy, and in his dream, the cross shows up. It's the cross on which Christ was crucified. And, you know, things speak to us. I look at this phone, and I remember when I had it in Greece. I remember when I had it in Portugal. We often feel in the blend as if things are communicating to us. Well, in this blend, it's more. The cross can actually speak. And it says to this dreamer, look, you feel like you're a sinner, you can't be redeemed, but you can. I felt the same way. I was the instrument that caused the death of Christ. I was stained with his blood. The same nails were driven into me. I, you know, participated in this bad design, just like you, but I was redeemed. You can be redeemed. And there's another blend in here that's culturally very specific. That is a fane. A fane supports the Lord, and the cross is helping Christ fulfill his destiny, right? So the Christ is now a Lord, and the cross is a fane. And a very, very old story. Parts of it are carved on the Ruthwell cross. And most of these kinds of religious paintings consist of these blended stories. This is an Annunciation, of course. Here's the Virgin Mary. And I'm not only talking about the fact that the historical detail that comes in is not from the historical period of Mary and the angel. It comes usually from the historical period of the painter. And she's reading a book. Of course, there were no books in the time of Mary. And in fact, what she's usually reading is the story of the Annunciation, right, out of the Gospels, right? And nobody thinks this is chaotic. This is Rogier van der Weyden's Annunciation. The medallion above the bed is a depiction of the resurrection. So Christ is not yet born here in this scene. This is a unification of the whole of Christ's history from not being born to rising from the dead, right? And this is compressed into a human scale scene. Notice the angel comes in at human scale. You don't just see the foot of the angel that's 6 meters long or something like that, and human voice gets used because, of course, the divine needs to communicate with us. Here's the Marode altarpiece, and I'd like to point out that in this one, again, we have a lectionary, Trinitarian tracery windows of the sort that you see in a church, right? Up here in the upper left, and you're not going to be able to see this, there's a little homunculus, that's Christ, and he's bearing his own cross. He's tolerating his own cross, which he did station to station, right? And the breath of Christ, or the light, is coming, I mean of God, God's out there beyond the window, is sending him right to Mary's womb, right? So in the Annunciation, at the moment of the Annunciation, the future is clear. Christ is going to be born, right? There's the story of Christ's crucifixion, carrying the cross, and the story of Mary learning that she has been chosen by God. And they're separated in time. These two stories are blended into one scene in which, as it were, the eternity is present in this moment. So what I want to say is, if you'd like to see more sorts of things like the nature of the risk frame and how we can combine the verb risk with verbs like to and in and on, show up tomorrow and the day after. But this kind of blending, although it looks spectacular, is the basis of the modern human mind. And the principles that make this possible are the same ones that make language, syntax, frame semantics possible. Thank you very much.